The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Teen Vogue. Our first article is from the OG History series, in which we unearth history not told through a white, cis-hetero-patriarchal lens, and it's titled, Geronimo, Famous Apache Warrior, Had a Tragic Life Story. This article is by Ruth Hopkins and was published June 30th of 2021. Hollywood, race-based mascots, media, pop culture, and even textbooks have long perpetuated false, negative stereotypes about Native peoples meant to reinforce a whitewashed narrative of colonial conquest. One of the most pervasive caricatures of who we are is that the hostile, bloodthirsty savage. Geronimo, a fierce Chiricahua Apache warrior who defended his homeland from both Mexico and the United States, has perhaps been the most maligned by this mythology. Geronimo was indeed fearless, but savage could not be a more inaccurate description for him. Authorities killed his loved ones, ravaged his people, and at the end of his life, cruelly turned him into a traveling sideshow character. They were afraid of him because he bested them at every turn, repeatedly evading capture and escaping reservations that served as little more than prison camps. At one point, Geronimo had one quarter of the entire United States Army chasing him, and when he was finally caught, he was the last Native leader to formally surrender to the federal government. Geronimo was born in June of 1829 in present-day Arizona in No Doyon Canyon. His birth name was Goyekla, meaning one who yawns. He was from the Bedonkohi band, a relatively small subgroup of the Chiricahua Apache. War was all he knew. Even as a child, Geronimo had a bounty on his scalp, which was worth 25 pesos to the Mexican government. Apache people of the Southwest were surrounded by colonial European invaders who wanted their land. They had to defend themselves from the Mexican army to the south and the U.S. army to the north. Geronimo wasn't just a warrior, though. He was also a medicine man and a good hunter who provided for his family. Few ask why he fought so hard. His personal history reveals that Geronimo's rage against colonial trespassers was driven by grief. The first great outrage came with the signing of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, at the end of the Mexican-American War. Part of the agreement involved Mexico ceding much of the Apache Nation's land to the United States. Then, in 1854, the United States used the Gadsden Purchase to pay Mexico $10 million for 29,670 square miles that would later become part of Arizona and New Mexico, pretty much the remainder of Chiricahua Apache territory. Just 4 years later, while he was away on a trading trip, Mexican soldiers led by Colonel Jose Maria Carrasco attacked Geronimo's band. They murdered dozens of Apache, including Geronimo's mother, wife, and three young children. "I had lost all," he said in his autobiography. Geronimo's followers also believed that he had spiritual powers, and it was under this life-changing tragedy that he received a remarkable vision. While he was holding a ceremony after the slaughter of his family, he says a voice told him, "No gun will ever kill you. I will guide your arrows." From that moment on, he devoted his life to avenging the brutal killings of his loved ones. After the death of the legendary Chiricahua Apache chief Cochise, Geronimo rose to prominence. Over the next few decades, the U.S. government attempted to coax Geronimo and his followers onto reservations, but he and his people managed to break out of their confinement every time, and they could not capture him. The U.S. military and elected officials faced years of humiliation as the news of his ability to evade them made headlines across the country. It had to have angered and frustrated them that natives, who were commonly viewed as primitive and were most certainly lacking adequate food, water, supplies, weapons, and ammunition, were defeating the military leaders of a country that considered itself a burgeoning international power. It was Geronimo's ancestral knowledge of the terrain that was one of his greatest strengths. Somehow, with women and children in tow, he and his warriors were able to travel as much as 70 miles a day through the desert. It couldn't go on forever, though. On September 4th, 1886, Geronimo agreed to surrender on the condition that he and his people would eventually be able to return to their homelands. He was with 17 of his bravest warriors and a handful of women and children, including a white boy named James McKinn, who had been captured by the Apache but loved living with them so much that he cried when he was returned to his parents. But the government broke its promise, and Geronimo never saw home again. Initially, he and his followers were transported by train to Fort Pickens, Florida, then Mount Vernon Barracks, Alabama, until they were finally imprisoned at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. While in Florida, the government took their children away and placed them at Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania for re-education. A third of them died at the notoriously inhumane boarding school. In his final years, Geronimo was presented to the public as a sort of living museum piece. He was allowed to take part in Wild West shows and World's Fairs, always under guard, where curious settlers could pay top dollar to gawk at the great Apache leader. Geronimo was even invited to participate in President Theodore Roosevelt's second inauguration. During a meeting with Roosevelt at the White House, he tried to plead his case. He asked the president to allow him and his followers to return to their ancestral lands. "Take the ropes from our hands," Geronimo appealed, with tears in his eyes. Roosevelt responded by telling Geronimo that he had a bad heart and that he and his people were not good Indians. Needless to say, the president denied Geronimo's request. After this proud, difficult life, the passionate warrior, the final holdout, spent his last 22 years as a prisoner of war. He died of pneumonia on February 17, 1909, at Fort Sill, where he is buried in the Beef Creek Apache Cemetery. Geronimo's last words before dying were, "I should never have surrendered. I should have fought until I was the last man alive." 4 years after his death, the government finally let the remainder of Geronimo's Chiricahua Apache followers leave Fort Sill. They were given the option to remain in Oklahoma or return to New Mexico and live on a reservation. Most returned to the West. Geronimo wasn't savage at all. He simply loved his family, his people, and his homelands, and was willing to protect them at all cost. His legend lives on. The next article is titled, "These Young Entrepreneurs Are Reclaiming Beauty Spaces for Black Women. From nail salons to beauty supply stores, these women are taking ownership." This article is by Asia Milia Ware, and there's photography in it by Kendall Besant, Joe Martinez, and Emmy Sue. It was published July 1st of 2021. Black women and our beauty, from our hair to our nails, is something that we heavily identify with from childhood. Getting our hair braided, sitting in the salon for hours, our first full set. It's also something that the world continuously tries to use against us. From not being hired for jobs because of the way our hair or nails look, to those same styles being worn and praised by women who don't look like us. It was only in 2019 that the Crown Act, which stands for Create a Respectful and Open Workplace for Natural Hair, was passed in California and New York, a law that prevents workplace discrimination against natural and protective hairstyles. This means that up until 2 years ago, Black people could be discriminated against simply because of the way we wore our hair. It's exactly why Black women found safe spaces in places like the beauty salon, where you can be your full self with other women who look like you and walk out feeling like $1 million. In other spaces like beauty supply stores and nail salons, there has often been deep-rooted tension and anti-Blackness among the owners of the shops and their Black customers, with few Black women having ownership in these spaces. And while many Black women wear protective styles such as braids or weaves, there aren't many that own the hair that's used to create the look. Teen Vogue spoke with three Black women looking to change that by owning their own shops and brands. Paris McKenzie became the youngest owner of a beauty supply store, opening one at just 16 years old in Brooklyn. Ryan Baker is the youngest Black owner of a luxury nail salon in North Carolina. Sierra Imani May is the first person to start a plant-based braiding hair company. These are three game changers and beauty bosses creating more safe spaces for other Black women. Paris McKenzie, age 17, owner of Paris Beauty Supplies. Teen Vogue asked, "When did your passion for beauty start?" Paris stated, "My mom owned a beauty salon and I was in there basically my whole life. If I didn't grow up in a salon, I probably would have never learned how to actually do hair or to do nails. I was never a sit at home and do chores type of kid. I was a sit in the salon, wipe the chairs down type of kid. One day I was in there and my mom had a wig and made me color it, and it came out really well. I've been doing hair ever since." How did you pivot from doing hair to having your own beauty supply store? I knew the impact it would have. I was only 16 years old, and the impact of a Black 16-year-old girl opening up a beauty supply store changes everything, and that's exactly what it did. The previous store was stocked as a regular beauty supply store, so my main priority is to stock the shelves for the community, because that's who is shopping in there, the community. What did you stock the shelves with? We're located in Flatbush, so the community has a lot of young Black women. There are a lot of young girls now that own salons on Church Avenue, and there are a lot of upcoming YouTubers. That's really who the community is. It's these Black girls that have found themselves through beauty, and now they are somewhere where they can express themselves even more through beauty. I want them to be able to walk into the beauty supply store and find just what they need, from wigs to natural hair. I have low porosity hair, and when I went natural after being relaxed for so many years, it was so hard for me to find products and a beauty supply store that kept me in mind. And now we have so many testimonies of our customers coming in and finally finding products that work for them. What was your first experience in a beauty supply store? No matter where I went, I always felt like I couldn't find what I wanted, unless it was hair colors, when I started coloring wigs. That's the only time I probably could find something that I really, really wanted. I've always been in Korean-owned stores, and I feel like that's what gave me the push to own my own store now. I always went into stores that I wasn't comfortable in and felt like I wasn't being properly assisted. Sometimes you have to experience those times for you to be able to know what it feels like and try to do the opposite. How important is it for you to have Black-owned products on your shelves? Very. I love having Black-owned beauty products in the store. It's not something I watch by number, but it's something that I just feel like needs to be there. Miel Organics, TGIN, and Talia Wahid are some products we have. Ryan Baker, age 21, owner of the Nail Doctor and Company Salon. Teen Vogue asked, "When did your passion for nails start?" Ryan answered, "I actually started doing nails when I was 16, and it started as a rebellion thing against my mom. I had to ask my mom to get acrylics, and she said no. I was like, well, she can't say I can't get them if I know how to do them myself. So I started learning how to do that myself on YouTube. I used to grab girls from school and sneak them into my mom's garage after school, and I'd practice on their nails. What did you love about nails as a child? My aunt does hair, and I remember she used to wear these really long, square, shiny red acrylic nails, and I was just in love. You know how black moms would say, you can't wear red when you're a kid, that's a grown-up color? That was my mom, so I could not wait until I was an adult, because I was like, I'm going to get my nails just like that. That's how red became my signature color. What sets you apart as a nail artist? The amount of passion I have for it. I think a lot of people get into the nail industry because they hear about how much money they could potentially make, or they have one bad experience with a nail tech and they're like, man, this is easy. I can do it myself. Then they find out how hard our jobs really are. But for me, the dollar is not important to me at all. I have a real passion for what I do, and my clients can tell. I work really hard to teach them about the health and care of their natural nails. I want them to grow their natural nails. I'm not just about to slap on some acrylic and send you out the door. I take time to really build a relationship with my clients. I build it on trust and honesty, and a lot of transparency as well. Why did you want to open a luxury salon? Creating this luxury salon was something that I felt was important for the culture. I feel like a lot of times while we are the innovators of these things, we get the scraps. I remember when Kim Kardashian had chains on her nails and everybody was like, oh my God, Kim Kardashian's wearing chains on her nails. She's so cool. It was like, do y'all not remember Janet Jackson and Busta Rhymes? Or how encapsulating money in nails did not start until Bernadette Thompson did Lil' Kim's nails for the Get Money video? People just don't give us our props. Sierra Imani May, age 26, founder of Rebundle. Teen Vogue asked, what motivated you to start a plant-based braiding company? Sierra answered, I was looking for something that was healthy and sustainable. I've suffered from scalp irritation many times before with plastic hair, so when I learned more about the chemicals, I started to really dive into the lack of research. Plant-based hair was a viable alternative to what was currently available. What was your first experience like getting your hair braided? I had really long hair growing up, so I don't think that I started getting extensions until maybe I was around 7 or 8. I remember the girl who used to braid my hair being super heavy-handed, the whole experience being uncomfortable and painful. It hurt getting it put in, but the care afterwards shocked me. I would ask, how could you itch so much? Why does it itch so bad? I had actual rashes on my face and my neck. Black women are often kept out of the sustainability conversation as it's been gaining more traction, especially when it comes to our hair. How do you want to change that? The intersection that we sit at has been overlooked because there hasn't been enough black women who wear braids in conversations about what it's like in the daily practice in our lives. The reception is so positive because it's really taking a look at a decade-old product, but a century-old practice, and reimagining what these styles can mean to our culture and to our environment. We're no longer accepting poor products and dismissing the waste that is created by our hair at the same time. It's really an opportunity to reassess our relationship with products that are not sustainable. If there's an alternative, what does it look like, and how does it function, and how do we make it available? How do you and Just Rebundle want to be a game changer and a part of that conversation? There's a lot of miseducation around synthetic hair products. We've spent a lot of time sharing what we've learned in the process and sharing what we know about the effects that it has on the climate. That data didn't exist. It's not something that's being tracked. It's not like toothbrushes or plastic bottles. It's kind of quantifiable. What are some of the challenges of being a black woman entrepreneur that you face? Funding was the first challenge, and conveying the story came with that. When I'm trying to get into these programs and get grants, trying to tell this story of, hey, here's what's happening with braiding hair specifically as black women and how I want to solve it. It took a lot of practice to be able to craft that narrative where anyone could understand it. People might get it when I first tell them, but they also might not understand the concept of a plant-based. So I had to really explain how we're having these negative reactions with chemicals, and I want to make something that doesn't have them, and I also don't want to be wasteful. And for the photographer for this article, again, they were Kendall Besant for Paris, Emmy Sue for Ryan, and Joe Martinez for Sierra. The hairstylist was Susan Oludeli for Paris. The art director was Emily Zerimis. And the fashion director was Tahira Hairston. And the visual editor, Louisiana Gelpie. The next article is titled, Ariana Grande is giving away $2 million in free therapy with BetterHelp. This article is by Brittany McNamara and was published June 30th of 2021. And a quick note at the top of the article, it states, shortly after the partnership with Ariana Grande went live, BetterHelp announced it would double the amount of free therapy it will give away, upping the amount to $2 million worth of service. But previously, just when you thought Ariana Grande had reached peak icon status, she went ahead and one-upped herself. In an Instagram post on Tuesday, Ari announced that she's working with BetterHelp to help bring free therapy to the masses. Ariana wrote that she and BetterHelp, a digital therapy app, will give away $1 million in therapy, helping people get 1 month of free therapy through the service. Long a mental health advocate, Ariana said the partnership is in hopes of opening the doors of therapy so that it's not just for a privileged few. Thrilled to be working with BetterHelp to give away $1 million of free therapy, she wrote. While acknowledging that therapy should not be for a privileged few, but something everyone has access to, and acknowledging that this doesn't fix that issue in the long run, I really wanted to do this anyway, in hopes of inspiring you to dip a toe in, to feel okay asking for help, and to hopefully rid your minds of any sort of self-judgment in doing so. Even though one in five adults experience mental illness, not everyone seeks treatment. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 45% of adults with a mental illness will seek treatment in a given year. While there are many reasons someone who needs it might not get therapy, cost is one of them. Still, whether or not you have insurance, there are options available. Services like BetterHelp and Talkspace offer somewhat affordable options, and some therapists offer sliding scale payments. Ariana is right that a one-time effort to give away 1 month of free therapy won't fix the larger structural issue of being able to afford mental health care, but she's also right that it's a step in the right direction. Whether it lowers the barrier of entry enough for someone to start on a longer therapy journey, or provides 1 month of free 1 month of relief for someone in need for treatment, it's a start. For some, that start can make a huge difference, even if cost isn't the issue. In addition to cost, stigma can prevent people from seeking the therapy they need. Ariana has been open about her own mental health, which helps destigmatize it for so many. I so hope that this will be a helpful starting point and that you'll be able to build space for this in your lives and continue, Ariana wrote. Healing is not linear or easy, but you are worth the effort and time, I promise. And I want to go ahead and read the full Instagram post caption that she included. It says, thrilled to be working with BetterHelp to give away $1 million of free therapy, which we now know is $2 million because BetterHelp has matched it. While acknowledging that therapy should not be for a privileged few, but something everyone has access to, and acknowledging that this doesn't fix that issue in the long run, I really wanted to do this anyway in hopes of inspiring you to dip a toe in, to feel okay asking for help, and to hopefully rid your minds of any sort of self-judgment in doing so. I hope that you'll take advantage of this opportunity and go to betterhelp.com/Ariana to be matched with a licensed therapist for 1 free month. After that, you'll have the choice to renew and continue. I so hope that this will be a helpful starting point and that you'll be able to build space for this in your lives and continue. Healing is not linear or easy, but you are worth the effort and time, I promise. Thank you so much to BetterHelp, and I can't wait to do more work together. And on that same note, I think I will read from an old article, snippets from an old article titled The Best Advice from Therapist from 50 Different People. And in here, Ethan writes, his therapist advice was, "When I get home, I get excited about using a new soap I bought for washing my dishes. Things we look forward to make us happy for a reason, and that will always be important." Ethan's thoughts, "It made me realize that we get happy about things when we live for ourselves." Billy's therapist says, "You seem to always talk about what you should or shouldn't do, how you should or shouldn't be. How do you actually feel?" Billy said, "For the first time, I realized that I was so focused on aligning with what I thought was right that I was suppressing, invalidating my feelings. This doesn't mean to act on every emotion, but it's important to acknowledge that the emotions you feel do exist and to find the root to why they exist in order to figure out how to best manage them." Jessica's therapist said, "There will always be someone having a harder time than you, but that doesn't mean what you're going through is any less hard." Jessica's thoughts, "I have a hard time acknowledging my challenges, and a lot of times I feel guilty because it could always be worse, so I tend to keep everything to myself. After my therapist and I had a long talk about how my challenges are just as valid, it helped me open up and talk about things I previously believed to be petty. They're important to talk about in my journey to recovery." Fernando's therapist said, "As long as it makes sense to you, that's all that should matter." Fernando's thoughts, "I felt empowered to take the reins of my life." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.